This edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 9th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 39th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Friends, Romans, online radio listeners, lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to play out of key. In this show, you'll hear interesting radio features on the following fascinating subjects. For example, I was lucky enough to head down to Provence last week for the opening week of the Rencontre d'Art Photography Festival to check out the curatorial and business trends in an ever-changing photography universe.
The single moment to choose a new photographer is for them an occasion to rediscuss what photography is about, and what Magnum is about.
Also last week, in music news, Norwegian synth-pop sensations Casio Kids dropped by to perform for us live in a great Midori House session.
I think there's a lot of melancholy, a little twinkle of sadness in there, in all that joyful music.
And in radio about radio news, the Culture Show's producer Katie Bilboa headed to Wapping, East London, to check out a pop-up place broadcasting to a very specialist audience.
An invisible picture palace, we've called it. We like that because it's invisible walls, invisible stories.
Plus, Brazilian rapper Criolo talks to us about taking his show on the road, Europe, this summer, and we learn how Tel Aviv is using culture to its brand advantage. And that little lot is all right here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. As an aperitif to that radio party, we'll play a song. This is from our Midori House session. It's Norway's finest, Casio Kids, performing Dressinen.
Thank you.
That was Cassio Kids with Dressinen, more from them later on the show. Now off we trot to Arles in Provence, cradled in the lowlands between Nîmes and Marseille, medieval, Roman, sun-drenched and beautiful, the town has been synonymous with photography since the Rencontre d'Arles Photography Festival started 40 years ago, and because the founder of the famous Magnum photo agency was an Arles native himself. Talking of which, I met up with Magnum's boss in Europe, Lorenza Bravetta, to talk Arles, talent spotting, and how digital and the internet have changed photography forever.
Arles and Magnum is a long story, I think, as Magnum's first and former director was François Abel, who came from Arles and returned to Arles after being in Magnum. So apart from that, I think that every year Magnum photographers spent time in Arles to see exhibitions, to see other exhibitions and to do their own exhibitions. So for us, it was when we thought to do the AGM for the first time somewhere else than in Paris, London or New York, Arles was an evidence, and we have decided to come here.
So it's a bit of a spiritual homecoming for Magnum then.
Yes.
And the AGM, having it in a different place, does that make it more relaxed when you're not in a place where, you know, Magnum is based? Does that make it a more relaxing event? Do people say different things at an AGM when it's in a different place?
Yes, I think it makes more easier as well, because it's longer. You never finish, you never stop. You spend 24 hours in being at the AGM. You don't go home when you finish the day, but at the same time you have the occasion to go in depth with people and to know better the staff, photographers, to talk, to have a moment of fun. So it's better. Yeah, I think it's the first time, but won't be the last one that we organize something like that outside our usual cities.
What are the sort of concerns for Magnum at its AGM? I mean, what sort of things are discussed? Are you talking about photography? Is it about money? I mean, obviously photography is like a lot of art forms or a lot of news forms as well. It's changing. Is that something you talk about a lot at Magnum?
So Magnum is a cooperative, so 60 owners that are traveling all year long, that come from many, many different countries. And I think the AGM is for them, first of all, the time to meet themselves after 1 year of many things that pass. So for them, it's a big, big party. It's like when you go back to see your family when you leave away somehow. Then, of course, the matter is photography and is how to continue with a great photography in the present economy. So we talk about money, we talk about photography, and we talk about life, and we talk about everything. I think that it's a crucial moment to align the strategy of the office and of the management on what photographers need to continue to be independent. So it's very useful for them to do a point on what their career is and what they want to go in the next year and the upcoming years. But it's a very important time for the staff to take the directive for the next year. So, yeah.
When you're looking at photographers' portfolios, you and the other 60 people that run Magnum, do you always need to agree on everything, or do some people look for a very individual voice almost as a photographer, or do some people interested in a certain geography? I mean, how do you choose who goes with you on the Magnum sort of journey?
I think the most important thing for Magnum photographers to select someone is to see that there is an approach on a long term to a subject. So it's not a matter of style, but it's a matter of a kind of approach to something. Then, of course, in Magnum there are many photojournalists, but these are more art photographers now, and so big fight and big exchange and a lot of votes against sometimes, but it's a good moment to discuss, and I think also to discuss about photography in general. So the single moment to choose a new photographer is for them an occasion to rediscuss what photography is about and what Magnum is about.
Well, maybe you can give us a brief idea of what those discussions are. What is photography about? What is Magnum about? What are the discussions that you have? Are you always sort of redefining what the agency does?
I think the baseline is the fact for Magnum to be a humanistic photographic approach. So that's the point that nobody has to forget. And then everybody can approach this subject with his own style. I don't know exactly how to say, but I think that now the priority for Magnum since 65 years is still the same, is the fact to continue to be independent, to continue to choose the subjects to treat, and so try to keep inside people who has the same kind of approach and that wants to do photography this way. No matter if for the press or if it's for cultural institutions or for new media or whatever, but this approach to document, to be on the actuality with a documentary view on humanistic approach and independency. I think these are the baselines.
And you mentioned that there's obviously news photography, reportage photography and art photography. Those three things sort of become the same, don't they? Pieces that were pieces of famous reportage, news photography, are now kind of considered works of art. Is that something you discuss as well? Sort of the time it takes from something going from being in a newspaper or a magazine to something being hung in a gallery. Is there, there's an interesting crossover there. Is that something that you talk about, especially after a couple of glasses of wine at the parties? Is that something that's a concern for Magnum as well?
Of course, but I think it's a big concern, but it's something that makes them to move ahead and to move ahead in the same spirit. So there are big groups inside of Magnum. They are not all on the same schema and on the same way, but I think that this kind of confrontation and discussion makes them go and move ahead on the same way and for the same reasons and with the same reach at the end. No matter if at the end they are hanged on in a museum or they appear in a newspaper.
Is there a similarity between those two things? What makes a great news photograph also makes a great piece of art? I mean, is it this, do you think it's the same eye behind the lens for picking out an amazing subject?
I would not say the same eye, but the same approach, the same integrity in relating something about the world. So then it depends from the individuality, where they want to be presented and how they want to be presented, but this is something that comes after. On the base, their approach is just, I'm interested in something and I approach that subject with my eye and with my integrity. And then it's Magnum that helped them to be shown through cultural institution or through press or something else. So it's not part of their démarche. Somehow, where they will be shown.
And when you're at Arles, when Magnum is at Arles, when you are in Arles, are you looking for new talent, or is it an opportunity for Magnum to sort of show off its own talent and its successful year?
I really would say both. You are in Arles, you are in many other festivals and fairs and exhibitions around the world, because of course we are all looking for what is happening around Magnum. We are all conscious about the fact that Magnum is not the only reality or the reference, and somehow is one reality in between many others. So we are all looking for something new and what's happened around. But of course it's a mix of two, and Arles is an important moment to show as well what is going on in Magnum, and specifically this year, where we will have a few nights dedicated to Magnum photographers and few exhibitions as well.
Yeah, I wonder if people even on the outside who aren't in the photographic world have heard of Magnum. Do you think that the health of Magnum goes hand in hand with the sort of health of photography?
Yeah.
The trends?
Yeah. I think that they are linked, and Magnum play an important role the photography market and the photography world in general, yeah.
And I wonder what, you know, obviously newspapers and magazines commission less original photography, there's less money for it. Does that affect you?
It has affected us as everybody, maybe less than the others, but since 10 years, it's not new, it's not of these last few years. I think that from the beginning, Magnum was on this kind of approach, very independent. So the fact to be owner of their own agency allowed the photographer to choose the subjects they want to treat. So also when the press market was very healthy, I think many of them preferred to live on their own money and then resell instead of giving a particular subject and having constraints. So probably the change and the crisis affect less Magnum than others. And I think that this has pushed Magnum to find new way to produce, continue to be independent. And this has been a very big stimulus to the photographers and to the staff. So yes, it has affected Magnum, but I think it has been turned into an opportunity. And in fact, we are doing many new things that in the last 3, 4 years, 5 years, we have developed successfully. And I think that's important not only for Magnum, but for the photographic world.
And that was Lorenza Bravetta and I chatting at the Rencontre d'Arles Photography Festival last week. Earlier this month, Brazilian rapper Criolo and his producer, Daniel Ganjaman, oh yes, were in London for the Back to Black Festival and playing a few gigs in Europe too. His latest album, Nona Aurelia, released in 2011, was applauded by the critics. With an energetic mix of rhythms, Criolo is the anointed musical king of a country that's renowned for great music from bossa nova to some funky tropical electro pop. And Brazilian researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco met them in our studios to discuss that wonderful new work.
Mandei falar pra não arrastar, não botar o fé, subir os dois tiozinhos.
Eu me recordo que os primeiros versos que fiz eu tinha de 11 para 12 anos de idade.
When I wrote my first rhymes, I was 11 or 12 years old, and in my home, my parents used to share moments of poetry, even with our harsh reality. My mother used to write poetry and chronicles, and my father used to love music, especially samba. I was born in this environment, and in the neighborhood I used to live in, there were people from every single part of Brazil. So you grew up with this cultural diversity. When I was 12, I noticed young people playing with words, and that was rap. After that, I didn't want to stop. I felt I was part of something. And I was getting to know people, developing stories, and myself as a man and a citizen, someone that doesn't want to stop doing what he likes. And I've met some dear people during this process. Overall, it's been 23 years so far, and I've met a lot of special people who've shared these moments with me.
Were you surprised at the reaction of the critic and public with your album, Nona Aurelia?
Foi algo inesperado. Muito inesperado.
It was something unexpected because those songs are part of my thoughts from 15 or 20 years ago and were some sort of register to share with me and my family. The construction of this album came about because of my need to have this for me and for my family. It was not pretentious at all. Daniel and Marcelo told me that there was something that could be shared with more people. It's all a great surprise.
What were your main musical influences in this album? It's a fascinating mix of rhythms.
O Criolo, ele chegou com a... com essa parcela de...
Criolo came to us with a very resolved idea of what his music would sound like. The moment we went to the studio, we knew which way to follow. Of course, he needed some direction, because he goes through so many genres. From the first session until the last, his vocals are consistent in sound. I think Criolo managed to absorb clearly his life experiences, and this was reflected in the album. At the beginning, it was a bit of a problem, because the album looked like it was all over the place in terms of different genres. But in the end, what made the album is Criolo as a person, musician and artist. The album is called Nona Aurelia because of this mixture.
Não existe amor em SP, um labirinto místico, onde os grafites gritam, não dá pra descrever. Uma linda frase de postal tão doce.
I would like to mention a song in special called Não Existe Amor em SP, There Is No Love in São Paulo, which is very moving, especially because I'm from São Paulo as well. Is it true that there is no love in São Paulo?
Os corações das pessoas.
The hearts of people in a big city. In a city that communicates with the world, but it's also a portrait of so many places in our continental country. There are lots of different worlds on those streets, and hard-fighting people. People who want to contribute and notice that the city doesn't take care of its citizens. And that's my reason for singing this song.
Can you tell me about your new projects?
Pois é, por enquanto a gente está pouco focado nessa coisa da turnê. Até porque a demanda está muito grande. Lá no Brasil, especialmente, a gente está fazendo show com uma quantidade de shows bem bacana por mês e tal.
For now, we're focused with the tour, because the demand is high. In Brazil, especially, we're doing several shows a month. And Nona Aurelia, besides being released in 2011, is still being discussed, and people are still discovering the album. And we want to record something by the end of the year, to be released next year. And to end the concert season, we'll be back here in November, and the album will come out next year.
You defend several causes, right, Criolo?
A vida que eu vivo, né? E toda a história da minha família e
It's the life I live. It's the story of my family and the life of people that I love. I just tried to be honest. You don't need to create characters if you have the conscience of your role, because you are already.
That was Brazilian sensation Criolo, and we were playing Lion Man from his album No Na Aurelia. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're going to visit a magical greenhouse full of old records after this.
Premiering on Monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake. All of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film plus our top 25 most livable city countdown on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, here on Monocle 24. Now, we're big fans of the medium of radio here on the show. So when we heard that Radio Project and friend of Monocle, In the Dark, had set up a shop down in Wapping, next to East London's Docklands, we were intrigued. Indeed, the gang have taken over an old greenhouse, now known as the Invisible Picture Palace. It's a place where anyone can go and listen to or buy a vast range of archive radio recordings and sound art from all over the world. Sound interesting, you think? Well, that's exactly what my radio-adoring producer Katie Bilboa thought, so she braved the Docklands Light Railway to meet Nina Garthwaite, who helped set up the project, and find out more.
It's like a tiny peninsula stretching out into the bay.
I met a man.
It's not a lot of trees, it's only around a few houses in town.
I travelled to Iceland to see him again.
But when we come driving to the town...
12 years ago, Jules Wright, who runs the Wapping Project, took over this place and turned it into a restaurant and an art gallery, and also made the decision to put a greenhouse here in the garden, which we've just turned into a radio record store. An invisible picture palace, we've called it. We like that because it's invisible walls, invisible stories.
There are almost no trees. People have this myth that you couldn't grow trees where the ocean was, where the salt was coming. But that is nonsense.
We'd started to hold monthly listening events in the greenhouse while it was a bookshop. And when we heard that it was closing down, we made a very impassioned plea. And our wishes were granted, and it's turned into our very own radio record store.
And we're going to have a little look inside now, aren't we?
We are, yes, if we can bear the heat.
Before we begin, we hope your 130-in-1 electronic project kit is the start of something that will excite and stimulate you.
So we walk into the greenhouse, and there's this long silver table down the side, and it's adorned with CDs and cassettes, I see, and there's some vinyl hanging up on a string. Can you just talk about the kind of range of stuff that we're seeing in front of us?
We basically have stuff from secondhand LPs found in junk shops of really beautiful classic radio pieces to completely contemporary podcasts that we're making up specially on CD that don't already exist on CD, and everything in between. One thing that's been quite fun for me is because I think I always really needed an excuse to be spending money on old radio vinyls, and this is the excuse that I needed. So I've been like rummaging around in charity shops and online, eBay, what have you, and finding some really brilliant old radio pieces, some of them really well known, like this record here of Singing the Fishing.
Kawaii hair and fishermen that work the nets the hill year round.
with a tenor sail to the north and minch to fish the western herring grew.
We have easel, engine, nylon, nets, RT, and echo sounder set, and a crew of ten to toil and sweat for the water fish for the herring.
Oh. Which is a real classic radio piece that was made as part of a series in the 50s and 60s by a guy called Charles Parker, and with the music of Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger. And this was a totally groundbreaking piece of radio that's really informed a lot of feature makers ever since, partly because it was the first time they used people's actual voices. So they used to, if somebody had a regional accent, they would interview them, then they would transcribe everything that they said and get an actor to read it out.
You know, all the voices belong to different boats. Just work in direction finder and get the bearings of where they are from you, the people that are among the fish.
A lot of it is really strong region. Even now, like, I'm listening and I'm don't always.
You see why they got the voiceover artists in.
Yeah, but also you can hear what would have been lost if they'd have done that. And also, you know, the use of music, the way that they put the thing together has been really influential.
We don't depend on the whales so much nowadays, you see. Once we see the whales, if we get our echo sounder going to locate the shoals.
Is it about kind of celebrating those voices?
It's about celebrating the voices of the fishing communities and also the changing voices and what was going on at the time within the fishing community in terms of mechanisation of the whole process. So it's kind of exploring the change at that time. And it's a beautiful record. And it's amazing, like, when I saw that I could get this, it was like, wow!
In them days, you see, that was on the crest of the wave. Must have been a golden time. But we don't know anything about that. Our generation just missed that, you see. We come in for the low when the market is gone.
I saw this one online, actually, and I couldn't really see any details of it, but I kind of like the cover, because we're in a greenhouse. I thought it'd be nice to have a piece about roses.
The incidence of pests and diseases often depends on the season, the climate and the situation. Greenfly, which is the bane of all rose growers, small caterpillars and cuckoo spit, it's a form of aphids. Capsids and other leaf-damaging pests can be controlled by spraying and dusting.
And all I knew is that it says a symposium of poetry, instruction, music and information from old and new sources about roses. And I thought, well, that sounds kind of weird, and I bought it.
You actually see the pests. Personally, I always assume that I'm going to get some pests and adopt the Boy Scouts' motto, be prepared.
The funny thing about it is when I read the back of it, is it's actually produced by Gardner's Question Time team in 1970-something.
So this is an old BBC record, and Gardner's Question Time is a very famous BBC programme, basically, isn't it?
And it's a very sort of straight kind of programme. I mean, if there's anybody who hasn't heard Gardner's Question Time, it's a real staple on Radio 4. There's a crowd of gardeners, gardening fanatics, lovers, you know, just people who like to garden at home, come along and ask experts questions about, you know, whatever's happened to their geraniums and what could possibly be going wrong. And in my mind, it's quite a straightforward great programme, very enjoyable, very entertaining, but, like, not necessarily experimental in the way that it's produced. And so the idea, and you put this on and it starts with an electronic organ. Like, a bit of music, and then, like, someone steps in and starts reading some poetry.
How old is the rose? Well, in fact, its origin is hidden in the mists of antiquity. Ever since man learned to speak and to write down his thoughts, the rose has been there in his poetry, his music, his art, his literature, and, we presume, in his garden.
And then there's like a whole German piece about roses, and then someone else just giving you a bit of advice on how to look after your roses this summer. It's strange, and I'd love to know what would happen if somebody went up to the current producers of Gardener's Question Time and said, hey guys, I've got this idea, I think we should put together this album that, like, combines sound and poems and...
Sein Knabein Röslein stehen, Röslein auf der Heiden, war so jung und morgenschön, lief er schnell, es nah zu sehen.
It'd be unheard of, I guess, for the BBC to make something like this now, wouldn't it? It's really fascinating. I'd love to kind of find this man and, you know, hear his story.
Yeah. How did it come about? Exactly, that's a radio piece in and of itself.
Röslein auf der Heiden.
These are obviously physical releases of things. Is that part of what you're trying to do here, to sell and to support the idea of physical records and CDs and tapes?
I think the idea of a radio piece or audio piece as a sort of artifact is interesting, because it's the one art where there isn't something that you can have and touch, and quite often when something gets broadcast, it gets broadcast and then it's gone, and you don't necessarily have a chance to hear it ever again. I think part of it is starting to think about radio features and creative radio as art, I suppose, and as something tangible and something that is worth listening to again as well, actually, and something that's worth taking out of the shelf every now and again and thinking to yourself, oh, I'd really like to listen to that again.
But after you drink the sip, you leave a few drops of coffee in the cup, turn it upside down over your head, circle the cup three, or like this, so first of all, three in one direction, three in another.
This is just an incredibly wonderful and vast creative world of storytelling through sound that doesn't quite get seen in the same way as films and as literature and art and music. And I wonder whether something like this would help make a shift. Because if it did shift, I think it would be valued more. And I think it's something that's been really undervalued in this country, certainly, as part of our cultural heritage. And I think we have a very proud history of feature making, like I say, from the 1950s, 40s till now. It's something we should be proud of, and we aren't always.
We present Sam Lana of Winterton.
Up jumped the Erin, the king of the sea, said he to the skipper, look under your lee, singing windy old weather, boys, stormy old weather, boys, when the wind blow, we'll all go together.
And radio producers are the long-suffering creative people.
I know.
I think that, you know, the one sort of set of creatives that don't get that same kind of elevation as other artists. But they are, and there's a history, and there's a language, and it's a language that gets played with, it's a language that sort of gets explored and does interesting things, and that does interesting things to you when you engage with it. But for some reason, yeah, we do. We decided that then that they're not the same. But they are. I say they are. And that's what this glasshouse is all about.
There's no lazy man when airing about.
As we hunt the bonny shoals of herring.
When you're doing well and catching fish, they talk to them all the time. Come on, spin up, my darlings, come on. And they absolutely cajole them into the nets.
And those were the sounds from the archive radio LP Singing the Fishing, and a host of other wonderful audio delights. They were recommended by the captivating Nina Garthwaite at the Invisible Picture Palace in Wapping, East London, which opens officially on the 21st of July. Nice. Still to come, in part two, we'll be talking with Casio Kids and enjoying still more of their Midori House session, and we'll hear how Tel Aviv is increasing news in cultural events to market itself to the wider world. Yep, you heard me, the wider world. What else would you need in life other than culture on Monocle 24? So let's have another song now from this week's Midori House session. This is Casio Kids with Grontlis y Aleled.
Al Alaska, the banner, come.
Als vi sätter i kväll där kan det vara bra. Och leken utan att tala stäcken. Och kurva med sin bästa kamrat. Kan det vara bra? Kan det vara bra? Och kurva med sin bästa kamrat. Och bo på en liten ö. Kan det vara bra? Och stäng ut ensam i köket. Kan det vara
ja, 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 ja.
Och skriva om sin dag. Kan det vara
ja, 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 ja.
No, alle andre har en dag og sanses land. Alle har en halsevitag og for deg. Og ikke seg ifra når du står uten klær. I en by med bare grønne lys. Hvor skal jeg ta?
And that was Casio Kids with Grand Lys y Ale Led. After their Midori House session, culture producer Katie Wilbur sat down with the band for a wee chat.
Casio Kids, thank you so much for your session. Can I just say you've won the prize now for the most colourful session we've ever had here at Midori House.
Oh,
I'm just going to describe the scene for our listeners because obviously they can't see it. So you guys, there was an inflatable palm tree, some bananas, lots of colourful kit you had out there, I noticed, even your foot pedals and your percussion. Colour's obviously a big thing. I mean, your music is very bright and loud. And another thing I should say for people listening is that that might have sounded like quite a full, upbeat, exciting sound, but that's a stripped back version of your normal performance.
It's pretty different, actually. It's normally, today we were four guys playing. Normally we have drums and bass guitar and a much more beat-oriented sound when we do live shows. This was kind of an unusual setting for us.
The kind of the strangest setting must be when we played in a kindergarten at 9 a.m. for the age group of 0 to 3.
Why did you end up playing for a kindergarten?
We had a show there in various kindergartens in the Bergen area. In each kindergarten, we did like the different age groups. It's quite hard to kind of interpret the feedback of the audience in a way.
Bergen, where you're from in Norway. Tell me about this place, because you introduce yourself on stage. You said we've come from Bergen. And I wonder, what's the music scene like there? And are you unusual from there, or are there lots of bands doing the same kind of thing as you?
I wouldn't say there's many bands that kind of sound has a similar sound to us. It's very varied what kind of music people make there, everything from electronic to, I mean, the metal scene is probably one of the best known.
We like a lot of kind of Nordic music here, and one of the things that we notice quite a lot is there's often a kind of a darkness to some of this music. I don't hear that much in your music, although some of the songs today I felt like I could hear a hint of darkness. And I'm just wondering, you know, do you think you kind of form part of that tradition? And is that because of these long dark winters that people have to go through? Do you think that kind of feeds into your work?
I think it's got something to do with it. And I think not necessarily darkness, but I think there's a lot of melancholy. A lot of like sadness, a little twinkle of sadness in there, in all that joyful music.
Yeah, it comes from the horrible weather in Bergen.
It always rains.
It rains a lot.
So,
does that explain the title of the last song you played when you said never, and then you said we're never going to have fun again?
Yeah, the Aldris Gomanage, we're never going to have any fun is the name of that song.
It's more like a reaction to a period where we were touring way too much, always traveling, never any time to chill back and have fun.
So you were saying there's never any time to do that. We need
I mean, we're quite spoiled. We have a lot of fun on tour. Age group 0 to 3, they're not sure. 3 to 6 are very excited. I think that, you know, we get slightly different reactions, I guess, from playing in Scandinavia and outside of Scandinavia, where people don't understand the words, because, you know, some of the songs have a really special theme that goes with the melody. And but at the same time, I think our music works on many levels, or at least that's what we heard with me and Frederick, we do a lot of harmonies, and also the beats and just the sounds that we use are maybe even more important.
I think the mood of the songs come across, even though people don't understand the actual lyric, and the reactions abroad is surprisingly similar to in Norway. It's we've come to realize that it's not that important that people understand what you're singing.
Well, I guess, and even people in Moscow and Tokyo sing along.
They
tried singing along.
Gibberish. Yeah.
So they're just kind of making the noise. Yeah. They're not saying the words. It's a bit like when I say, voice. I guess it's that thing where your voices kind of become an instrument, don't they? And it's not you don't necessarily have to understand the words to be able to get the feel of the song and enjoy it. So you're over in the UK at the moment, you're playing some gigs. Are you going to be doing any festivals? Are you doing any festivals across Europe or the rest of the world this summer?
This weekend we're playing 2 small festivals in outside of London.
I can imagine you guys are great at a festival. Lots of energy, lots of colour.
It's a lot of fun, yeah. I especially enjoy English festivals. It seems like people are really...
People make an effort in English festivals. No one really dresses up like they do in England. In anywhere we have been in festivals in Europe or in Norway. Yeah. It doesn't happen.
That was Frederick, Omar and Shetil from Casio Kids talking to Monocle's Katie Bilboa. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're only off to Tel Aviv after this.
To keep up to date on the latest issue of Monocle, new films on our website, products in our shops, and new programmes on Monocle 24, sign up for our free weekly bulletin. We'll tell you about special Monocle events and make sure you're ahead of the curve with all the happenings at Midori House. Just go to monocle.com to subscribe. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. Now, Tel Aviv is aggressively marketing itself as one of the premier liberal destinations in the Middle East. In fact, it's trying to tell people that it's not really aggressive at all. Sunny beaches, a vibrant nightlife and a thriving cultural scene, the city certainly has its fair share of eclectic diversions on offer for the curious traveller. Yet Israel's political situation continues to stymie Tel Aviv's branding efforts as a city apart from the conflict. As a response, city planners are turning local cultural festivals into the international spectacles with the hope of attracting new foreign tourists. This year's White Night was no exception, as Monocle's Joseph Dana found out in Tel Aviv.
Once a year, Israel's cultural capital turns its streets into a maze of performance and art. In a celebration of summer and the city's cultural heritage, Israelis flood Tel Aviv's humid streets as bands play and galleries open their doors until sunrise. Initially an internal Israeli celebration, the city is looking to market White Night as a part of an international branding campaign, which downplays politics in favor of culture. Chris Bourne is the international editor for Time Out London and was in Tel Aviv to gauge this year's White Night.
It's my first time in Tel Aviv. I don't know what to expect, to be honest, but I keep being told it's going to be amazing. So we turned up, we saw Nouvelle Vogue in rehearsal yesterday. We stepped out of a cab. We keep seeing lots of stages being set up and lights being erected everywhere around the city. So it promises to be quite a good night, I think, yeah.
Tel Aviv's White Night started as a small celebration in 2003. After UNESCO declared the city a World Heritage Site because of its collection of Bauhaus architecture. The White City, as UNESCO dubbed Tel Aviv, needed a white night. Since then, Israelis from Jerusalem, Haifa, and points further afield have descended on Tel Aviv with the hopes in taking part in its brittle hedonism. Hila Oren, the general manager of the city's branding campaign.
What is nice about it is it started as an internal, but as the good things that they start by mistakes, and then we realize that they're so good. Of course, now it is focused outside for the international. So once the local people really hugged this event and they liked it so much, we understood we have something very good in our hands, and then we had some advertising overseas to bring people, just like the Gay Parade a month ago. That's another example, which is quite similar to the White Night, because 14 years ago when the Gay Parade started, it started again as a local thing, something that we all wanted to feel familiar with the values of pluralism and tolerance, etc., etc. But then it turned out to be a great event that people want to come and experience the event of the thing aside from the values.
Strolling serendipitously on White Night, you can find plentiful pubs overflowing with patrons, sidewalk concerts, and inviting galleries. Yet Tel Aviv's version of White Night is markedly different than the more well-known Paris incarnation. Time Out Paris's art editor, Tanya Brimson, explains the differences she sees between the two all-night city festivals from a rooftop event overlooking the Mediterranean Sea.
Might be a bit different from the White Night in Tel Aviv because it's very much based on art installations and illuminating facades and kind of surprising Parisians with art, really. More art than performances. And I think that in Tel Aviv it feels like it's more about the music and the night and nightlife. So I'm really excited about discovering this other White Night, which seems more dynamic. The city in itself is more welcoming for this kind of night because you have the sunshine, you have the fun, you have the sea, and you have all these nightlife venues that we don't have so much in Paris. And mostly Paris is such a big city compared to Tel Aviv that you have to concentrate on areas, and it's kind of difficult to get a feeling of the White Night as a global event, and you'll have to focus on certain venues, whereas here I feel like the whole city is going to be alive.
Tel Aviv's international appeal is a complex one to understand. The city is deeply connected with the politics of Israel, and international campaigns to stop musicians from performing here have started to make an impact. Last month's Gay Pride Parade and the White Night celebrations are city planners' attempts to win back international appeal. Michael Omerman is a journalist with the English-language daily, the Jerusalem Post.
I don't know if you can directly connect those events to an increase in tourism, but there definitely is one. So whatever efforts they're making seem to be working. According to the Israeli Tourism Ministry, the first quarter of 2012 saw an all-time number of incoming tourists. And if you walk down, especially the beach neighborhoods of central and northern Tel Aviv, it's hard to hear Hebrew sometimes. There's definitely a large number of tourists and foreigners coming to the city. If somebody were to come to Tel Aviv for that night, they would definitely get a feel for the atmosphere of the nightlife, of the residents, of the humidity in the air, and the energy in the air.
Despite the success of White Night, Israel is still learning how to put on a truly world-class cultural festival. Tel Aviv has become a leader in marketing its beaches, its sun, and its people, while downplaying its political problems. With a touch more focus on its unique artistic character, White Night in the White City will surely find its place alongside its European counterparts. For Monocle, in Tel Aviv, I'm Joseph Dana.
And that report from Israel concludes this week's Mighty Culture Show. Next week, we'll be hearing about a Maori boy genius and meeting the man who's travelled every bus route in Buenos Aires and written a book about it. And you thought I was weird. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. The show is produced by a killer combination of Katie Bilboa, Dawn Trump and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from the Midori House session. This is Casio Kids with Aldri Ska Mit Head That Goy. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you so much.